Midnight with host DJ Tronic. Tronic does a live mix in the studio featuring the latest in house, techno, tech house, breaks, dubstep, and more. Tronic also has guest DJs in the studio and often talks about upcoming parties, club nights, and more. That's Plugged In, every first and third Fridays at 10 p.m., only on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5:02 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland students gear up for a possible district-wide strike by Portland teachers.
Over $1 million was spent on marijuana on the first day of its legalization in Colorado.
Peace talks began today between government and rebel groups in South Sudan. Violence continues to plague the countryside.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 3rd, 2014. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Several dozen people gathered this afternoon for a picket of Fubon Supermarket on Southeast 82nd Avenue in Portland. They challenged the store owner's treatment of some of its employees. They were forced to work long hours in unsafe and unsanitary conditions. Workers also had their wages withheld on numerous occasions and worked more hours than they were paid for. KBOO's Robin Ryan reports from the scene of the protest on 82nd Avenue.
Lies and tricks will not divide workers standing side by side. I'm at the Fubon Shopping Center near 82nd Division in Southeast Portland. We've got about a gathering of 30 to 40 people and the crowd continues to grow. There's a lot of honks and waves and support. Traffic is starting to get a little thick. We've seen a police cruiser go by a couple of times, and as I understand it, as folks were gathering, one of the organizers had suggested there was someone in a very, very large vehicle with Washington plates taking pictures with a super long zoom lens. I'm joined here by Sam Cassay.
Portland Solidarity Network does direct action campaigns against abusive bosses and landlords. Is out here standing in solidarity with two workers, Marisol and Norma, two former workers, Marisol and Norma, of Fubon Shopping Center, who were denied proper breaks. They Fubon forced them to work off of the clock, made them endure a racist working environment, and made Marisol do dangerous work while she was pregnant. We started the campaign this last summer in July, and Fubon responded by suing two of our organizers and the two women who stood up for their rights for $50,000. Fubon hasn't tried to push it any more than serving them and threatening and making threats to push it. Today we are doing a press conference and press release, giving everyone an update on where the campaign is, how Fubon has responded, and a picket, where today we are announcing a boycott on Fubon, an official boycott on Fubon, a series of community pickets we are calling the Fridays of Fury at Fubon, and those will start in the near future. And we are forming an alternative labor coalition to take on the campaign. So you can get on our list at PortlandSolidarityNetwork.org. You can catch us on Facebook at Facebook.com/PortlandSolidarityNetwork and Twitter at PDXSol.
My name is Jordan Benning. I'm out here to show my support to the Portland Solidarity Network, who are also supporting the former employees of FUBON. FUBON has absolutely disgusted me in the sense that they're willing to hire these people and then treat them completely horrible. I'm talking like having pregnant women lift 54 pounds of boxes of meat, not giving them good places to breastfeed, unsafe places to breastfeed. That's where they made them breastfeed. And then let alone the attack FUBON has now made against the Portland Solidarity Network is absolutely disturbing. This group, this organization is willing to stand up and help people find their voice, help people lift their voice. And FUBON is now making an attack not only to silence those former employees, but trying to silence a whole group of people that are willing to stand next to them. And then that disturbs me. That absolutely disturbs me. So that's why I'm out here showing my support today.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Portland public school teachers are currently in the bargaining process with the administration over contentious issues in the district's proposed contract for the teachers. If the talks break down, a strike could be imminent for Portland teachers, the first time in the district's history. KBOO reporter Keegan Heron spoke with Cleveland High School senior Ian Jackson, a member of the Portland Students Union, about the situation and what it means for students.
What are some of the contentious issues in the proposed contract that the district has offered to the teachers?
So the biggest thing that the students are focusing on are class size, the cap on class size. The district has proposed to remove the cap on class size. They've also proposed to remove the 180 student cap per teacher, so teachers could have up to 200, 210 students. They've also proposed a reduction in planning time for teachers and an increase in classes taught. And so we see those as the issues that directly affect us as students, and we'll see the most effect in our classrooms.
Now, is it possible that there would be a walkout on Monday?
On Monday the 13th?
Monday the 6th, this coming Monday?
We don't believe there'll be any walkouts on Monday the 6th, but we do have some other student actions at schools hosted by the unions later in that week.
Like what?
There may be a walkout at one of the schools. Some of the union chapters are doing art installations. Some of them, we're going to be compiling lists of things that students would like to see in their school to present to the board. So what we need to learn and how we don't necessarily see that playing out in the current contract negotiations, but would like to see happen in the educational system in years to come. So on January 13th, the Portland Student Union, in conjunction with the Portland Teachers Solidarity Campaign, is hosting a Pack the School Board meeting. We're going to have a rally at 5:30. And then we're going to march into the school board meeting at 6, and that's at the BESC, which is the district headquarters, 501 North Dixon Street. We'd like to send a message to the district that there's community support behind the teachers, and we don't support the district's pushing of their proposal, and we don't see it helping students in our schools. And so we want to tell them not to force a strike, and to agree to the schools Portland students deserve.
So as a student, what would you like to see more or less of in our public schools?
I'd like to see more democratic involvement in the public school system. So teachers and students working together to run the schools. I'd like transparency of the budget and then to have a democratic process when making that budget. I think that the more power that teachers and students have and parents have, the better our school system would run. I think that the bureaucracy within the school system really stifles a lot of the educational possibilities and the learning that goes on.
Now, if the district found enough substitutes to keep schools open, would you still attend class?
No, I would never cross the picket line and I don't think any of my peers would either. We all stand with the teachers, and that's one of the reasons for going out on the 13th, is to tell the district that none of us are going to cross a picket line, and we're going to stand in solidarity with our teachers until they win, because we're all in the struggle together, and so when they go on strike, we go on strike.
Exactly. And what led you to support the teachers in this issue? How did you become so involved?
I became involved going to the contract negotiations this summer. So we started attending them, a few fellow students, and then became more and more educated on the contract and where it was going. And we saw that the district was, you know, the 75 take back that the district started out with were quite radical, and we didn't want to see that happen in our educational system. And so we believe that standing with the teachers was the best thing for students and the best thing for our schools. And then we moved on from there and became more involved in our solidarity campaign with the teachers.
This is Keegan Herron with KBOO News.
On January 1st, Oregon's minimum wage increased by 15 cents, now $9.10 an hour. This makes it the second highest minimum wage in the country behind Washington, whose wage is $9.32. Oregon's minimum wage automatically adjusts every year to keep up with inflation. The federal minimum wage has remained stagnant at $7.25 for the past 6 years. For the nearly 100,000 Oregon residents earning minimum wage, this translates to an added $234 in their yearly paycheck. The Oregon Bureau of Labor estimates that this increase will lead to a $20 million boost for the state's economy. Oregon's in the middle when ranked for income inequality between all 50 states, though the U.S. has the highest inequality among Western countries. Since 1967, when the U.S. Census began tracking income inequality in households, the census with the highest income inequality was 2010.
Police in Cambodia opened fire on striking garment workers today, wounding 21 people and killing five. Police used live rounds, grenades, and tear gas against striking workers who threw stones and bottles. The crackdown on the striking workers began yesterday when police wounded 20. Unrest in Cambodia has been building since the election in July, which the opponents say was rigged. Anti-government protesters and union workers have come together to form the Cambodian National Rescue Party. They believe over 2 million votes were stolen and are calling for a new election. The workers at garment factories in Cambodia are paid less than workers in neighboring Thailand and Vietnam. Workers in Cambodia make about $80 a month, and are demanding that their pay be doubled. Most of these workers perform manual labor for the clothing industry, which uses Cambodian labor to keep costs low and profit margins high. The clashes today took place at the Canadia Industrial Park in Phnom Penh, home to dozens of factories that produce clothing for popular brands in the U.S., including Adidas, Puma, and H&M. Yesterday's police assault was at a factory which makes clothing for Walmart and The Gap.
From county officials to conservation advocates, a broad group is starting the new year with a fly-in to the nation's capital. They support the Public Lands and Renewable Energy Development Act to update what they say is an outdated leasing system for developing wind and solar resources on federal lands in Oregon. KBOO's Susan Cecil, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, has more on the story.
This weekend, outdoorsmen and some county officials from western states are flying into Washington, D.C. to revamp the way public land is leased for wind and solar projects. The Public Lands and Renewable Energy Development Act creates a pilot program to treat renewables more like oil and gas, with the developers paying royalties. Gary Thompson with the Association of Oregon Counties says his group is on board because the money would benefit the counties and the land itself.
25% back to the state, 25% to the counties, 15% to the permitting agency, and 35% would go to fund fish and wildlife habitat conservation and recreational enhancements.
Thompson says his area wouldn't be affected by a new leasing system, but he sees its potential, especially in eastern Oregon.
I think it's an excellent idea for some of these rural counties made up of 75-80% federal lands. There's a lot of good solar and wind and renewable opportunities. It's one way to help get some additional dollars in to help support the counties.
Funding for protecting fish and wildlife has also gained the approval of groups such as Trout Unlimited and the National Wildlife Federation. But the bill has been stuck in Senator Ron Wyden's Energy and Natural Resources Committee for almost a year. And in the House, Representative Greg Walden is the only Oregon congressman who isn't a co-sponsor. For KBOO News, I'm Susan Cecil.
A new law that went into effect this week in Oregon will allow new mothers to take home their placentas after giving birth. In many traditional countries, new mothers consume the placenta, either fresh or dried, and other cultures call for the burying of the placenta. In Cambodia, healers call the placenta, quote, the globe of the origin of the soul, end quote. Their placentas are buried to fertilize gardens. But until this week in Oregon, most new mothers had to leave their placenta behind in the hospital where it was disposed of or used for research. Some hospitals did allow women to take home their placentas, but there was no standard practice across the state. The new law, which went into effect on January 1st, was introduced by Oregon State Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer from Portland.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, host Beatrice H. Nass. She grew up in Uganda and now runs an NGO to assist other girls in making it through school in rural Uganda. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. This weekend's weather will likely be mostly sunny with highs in the mid-40s and lows down to 30 degrees overnight. The moon is a waxing crescent. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 31 counts per minute in North Portland, high of 54. In Raleigh Hills, the radiation count is 30 CPM, high of 47. Seattle has 30 CPM, high of 47. Hanford, Washington has 29 CPM, high of 46. Vancouver, B.C. has counts between 38 and 64 per minute. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 33 counts per minute with spikes up to 54. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's an odd headline. It's hard to summon sympathy for big banks. Well, yeah, and why would you try? This piece began with another odd sentence. It's no fun to be a banker these days. Really? I'd think that counting those multi-million dollar annual paychecks would be jolly fun. But money doesn't buy love, and it seems that the global princes of high finance are glum because they're not even respected, much less loved. Well, of course not. They've been pigs. No offense to pigs, but bankers have gotten filthy rich through greed, plundering, and damn the public narcissism. So not only are they social pariahs, but even bank regulators around the world are no longer as deferential as they were before the 2008 financial crash. While meek regulators haven't exactly turned into tigers, at least they're slapping some of the banking syndicates that caused the crash with multi-billion dollar fines, and they're even publicly scolding a few of the banksters. This has set off a pity party among Wall Streeters and other big bankers. At what point does this stop? Whined a Bank of America executive. Complaining about paying out $13 billion for some of his bank's crimes, a J.P. Morgan poobah said, "We should all be concerned that there doesn't seem to be a natural endpoint to how high fines can go." Note that he wasn't concerned about an endpoint to the crimes bankers are committing. Likewise, the top executive of Deutsche Bank was outraged that a German official has criticized bankers there for evading regulation. "It's irresponsible to comment in such a populist manner," cried the haughty banker. Again, no concern for the irresponsibility of bankers who keep evading regulations. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we have here is business as usual. For bankers, it's still all about themselves, money over ethics. And they wonder why they're not loved.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Sales of marijuana surpassed $1 million on Colorado's first day of legalizing the drug. There are 24 dispensaries across the state, mostly centered around Denver, though there are hundreds of applications for more. On the opening day, many pot shops hired security and police. Increased their presence in the neighborhood for fear of rowdy crowds waiting impatiently for the drug. However, city and state officials remarked how smooth the transition was. They say it can be an example for other states in the future. According to Colorado's law, one must be 21 or older to buy marijuana. One can possess up to an ounce at a time, and growing it yourself is legal as well, so long as there are no more than six plants. Last year, Colorado generated over $9 million in tax revenue from medical marijuana. The legalization of the drug is expected to dramatically increase this amount. Officials made clear that marijuana is still technically illegal on a federal level, so thousands of flyers were posted noting that transporting the drug over state lines is illegal.
Today, the federal government proposed deregulating corn and soybean seeds that are resistant to particular herbicides. Currently, seeds for the two crops that are immune to the Dow chemical-produced herbicide 2,4-D are only used in experimental trials, but this could soon change. Most soybean and corn varieties in the United States are genetically modified to withstand the common herbicide Roundup. However, over the years, many weeds have also grown immune to Roundup, causing scientists to search for another more effective weed killer. The weed killer 2,4-D is already the third most popular herbicide across the country. Thus, proponents say that corn and soybean seeds that are resistant to it will have no major impact on the ecosystem while simultaneously increasing crop yields. However, many agricultural scientists argue that this only perpetuates the cycle of weeds evolving immunity to stronger and stronger herbicides. There's also a likelihood that the seeds or the herbicides would spread from the fields in which they were sown or sprayed, thereby negatively impacting neighboring crops. Another cause for concern is that 2,4-D is one of the constituents in Agent Orange, a known toxin, though it is not the primary compound responsible for causing cancer. The USDA has already approved the genetically engineered seeds, but the EPA is conducting its own test, and the two agencies will decide in the coming months the fates of the seeds. The public has 45 days to comment to the USDA or the EPA.
The Oklahoma chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations today called on the U.S. Department of Justice to bring hate crimes against a man arrested for hitting a woman and slashing her car tires, while repeatedly calling her an effing Muslim. Stuart Manning has been charged at the state level with a hate crime with malicious intimidation, as well as assault and battery. He allegedly hit the woman in the forehead and stuck a knife in a tire on her vehicle. Police described the alleged victim as being from Lebanon and having an Arabic accent. The police report also that at the time of the assault, she was wearing a head wrap. Manning said that he was drunk at the time and has no memory of attacking the woman.
At least six people were killed today in clashes between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood protesters on the streets of Cairo. Last week, the government announced the Muslim Brotherhood would be labeled a terrorist organization, prompting daily demonstrations from the group's members. Since the army's coup in July, when President Mohamed Morsi was overthrown, thousands of Muslim Brotherhood leaders have been confined to jails across Egypt. The protests are leading up to a vote on January 14th and 15th to ratify a new constitution which would give more power to the military and ban religiously affiliated groups from participating directly in politics. Many protesters said they would boycott the upcoming elections, citing the current military rule as unconstitutional. Meanwhile, the government has pledged that the vote for a referendum on the Constitution will continue as scheduled. At least 1,500 civilians have been killed since Morsi's ouster, as well as 350 police and soldiers.
Today marked the beginning of peace talks between the South Sudan government and the rebel group that has opposed them in recent weeks. The rebel group is composed mostly of ethnic Nuer, led by the former vice president of South Sudan, Riek Machar. The Sudanese People's Liberation Army, or SPLA, are the government's forces and are largely composed of Dinka. In the past 3 weeks, over 1,000 have been killed in the fighting, and 200,000 have fled their homes to escape the renewed violence. The United States continues to evacuate embassy personnel from the capital of South Sudan, Juba. Even as the mediation meetings took place today, fighting was reported from the large city of Bor, which has changed hands three times in the past 3 weeks and is now under control of the rebels. Tensions began to rise in July when President Salva Kiir dismissed Machar as his vice president. The government claims there was a coup attempt in mid-December, though others have disputed this as simply an excuse to further ostracize the Nuer. Neighboring East African countries expressed concern over possible spillover from the conflict that could destabilize surrounding areas.
Nearly 20,000 people have been injured and over 500 have died in the 150 million-person nation of Bangladesh over the past 12 months due to political conflicts between the Islamist Bangladeshi Nationalist Party and the ruling secular Awami League. Among other antagonisms, the BNP is boycotting a forthcoming election due to Awami's unwillingness to install neutral parties in counting the vote. Over half of the seats are not going to be contested in the upcoming election due to the banning of Islamist candidates. There has also been a 48-hour moratorium called by the Bangladeshi National Party allies and their sympathizers to close shops and businesses and establish blockades of railways, main roads, and ports in an attempt to put pressure on the government to establish neutral counters of the vote. The Awami League is expected to hold on to most of its seats, and the election is seen by many as a farce. Awami supporters have stated that they expect the Bangladeshi National Party to dissolve most of the country's fragile democratic institutions if elected.
Earlier today, Chinese officials used helicopters, paramilitary police, and speedboats to seize 3 metric tons of crystal meth in the little village of Boshe in the city of Lufeng in southern China. The village reportedly makes 1/3 of China's illegal amphetamines. 1/5 of the town residents are suspected of being in on the local cottage industry of making the substance. The walled village of Boshe has resisted drug enforcement from Chinese authorities. Tactics include lining up motorcycles and throwing rocks at Chinese police.
The Hillsboro-based company Omega Morgan is set to transport the second of 3 megaloads of pipeline equipment from Oregon to Canada this weekend. The megaloads are headed to Fort McMurray, Alberta, as part of the construction of the tar sands pipeline. The second of the 3 megaloads has not faced any immediate delays. The first megaload was delayed several days by nonviolent protesters who chained themselves to the truck. They said they opposed the construction of the pipeline and the extraction of tar sands because of the projected impact on climate change. The large size and the scale of the megaload prevents it from traveling on major highways. It can only travel between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m., according to the Oregon Department of Transportation. This megaload is set to travel down large sections of Interstate 84, U.S. 395, U.S. 26, U.S. 20, and Oregon State Route 2000. Let me say that again, in Oregon State Route 201. listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Please call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Zoe White, Terry Eaton, Keegan Heron, Susan Cecil, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Keegan Heron. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. Stay tuned now for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, Beatrice Aching Nass. She grew up in Uganda, and she now runs an NGO to assist other girls in making it through school in rural Uganda. Have a great weekend. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Liam.
After extensive research, member input, and feedback from the Program Advisory Committee, KBOO Community Radio has decided to return Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez to its 4 to 5 p.m. time slot every weekday. Our three-month trial period airing the Tom Hartman Show in that time slot will come to an end January 3rd. We have heard from our friends at the brand new KXRY Radio that they will begin airing the Tom Hartman Show live and in its entirety beginning in February 2014. We thank Tom Hartman, his staff, and his listeners for their support of KBOO Radio during this time. Democracy